Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Intel's over the TikTok, 8 terabyte red drives, Vive wins, VR builds for gaming, GPS ain't dead, and how about that iPhone SE? All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 356, recorded March 24th, 2016. The end of TikTok. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, and, ladies and gentlemen, most delightful news and information and responses to questions about PC and mobile hardware anywhere in the known universe. A statement that will make my partner in crime, Mr. Ryan Shrout, tremendously uncomfortable.
I make no such claims that any of that issue falls on Patrick, right? If you have any concerns,
if it is not
his Twitter handle is. Yeah. But we do our best. We attempt. We try really hard to do what we can do and inform everybody in an entertaining and educational fashion.
We try, ladies and gentlemen. We try. What do you want to start out with? The V-NAND showdown, the Samsung 850 Evo V1 and V2 compared, or should we talk about your impressions of all the time you spent in VR land at GDC last week? We kind of covered the basics of the announcements at GDC last week, and I said, look, we're going to have Ryan on next week. He'll be back.
Yep.
And discussing. Yeah, I mean, because based on the conversations you and I had, it sounded like the HTC Vive 1 in terms of the gaming experience, the user experience, partially talking with you, partially talking to other people, and that a huge part of that was the Vive controllers versus, say, using a standard gaming pad, which is what most people experience the Oculus Rift with.
I think it's going to be a much more difficult conversation to have than I expected it to be. I thought, honestly, that these would be like, well, these are equivalent, and, you know, which one you buy is kind of a 50-50 proposition. It still may end up being that way, but I do believe after both my time at GDC last week and then I've done some stuff this week as well with VR. I've got a Vive Pre here that we've been able to use for a couple of days, and I've been able to mess around with some of the retail stuff as well. And my takeaway from GDC was that the whole room VR experience, the ability to stand up, move around, walk a few steps in any direction, have those controllers make the Vive a very unique experience relative to the Rift. And I still believe that's the case. But I also, in attempting to set up the Vive Pre in our office for the first time, had my first experience of, oh, we don't have enough space. We need to clear stuff out. We need to move things out of the way. Oh, look, I tried to reach for this thing in a game and I accidentally hit the TV monitor we were using for the computer. It's like, oh yeah, no, it's not a perfect thing yet. You know, and just gotta tweak your setup and everything. The Rift is very much going to be you sit at your desk, you set it up, and boom, you're done type of thing. There's one sensor. You don't have to worry about whole room. You can stand up or you can sit down. You need much less space. And the Vive can do all of that same type of stuff, but it's not being pushed or marketed, and the setup configuration doesn't do that way. When you set up a Vive Pre, you are asked to put these two lighthouses in opposite corners at eye level or above. You are asked to trace an outline of your room using one of the controllers, right? It's a process as opposed to just, oh, I'm installing software and sitting down at my desk with a controller or in front of your TV with a controller, whatever it happens to be. So they're very different experiences thus far. And I think people will find that the Oculus Rift will be the ease of use entry option for this, and it happens to be a couple hundred bucks cheaper. But the Vive Pre is more of a all-encompassing experience, right? Like the ability to turn around and use controllers, like the touch controllers. I forget what they're calling exactly, but the 3D positional controllers and interact with things, and you can play Job Simulator, and you can do all these things where you're interacting with stuff directly, and it's a more natural kind of experience of interacting and playing games. It's more physical. Like I played a game earlier today where like as a laser gets near you, it slows down into bullet time and you physically move your body out of the way to dodge it, right? That could be like doing squats and getting down onto the ground or quickly moving to your left or right. Always trying to be cognizant of not running into the things around you in the room if you have it set up poorly or something like that. So I still think I'll have more fun with the Vive Pre. If we look at like, what am I going to do in April? What am I going to do in May? What am I going to do in June? But I think you'll find that more people will have a better experience with the Rift just because of the ease of use and setup as opposed to the Pre, I think.
Is it safe to say that it is incredibly early still in the evolution of VR, that this all may change radically in the next 12 to 18 months? I mean, is it all going to get less expensive? Are these all going to drop to that $300 range next year? It seems like, I mean, I'll be honest with you, so many more games than I expected at launch. 50 for the HTC Vive last week, 30 for the Oculus Rift. You know, Valve, Steam, / HTC basically saying, we don't want exclusive titles. We want everybody to have all the titles because we need VR to succeed, I think, was kind of the feeling I got from that.
Yep. I think $300 might be a stretch, but I do believe, I had a conversation with somebody today, like if you waited until December to get into this, I think you may find that both these headsets are $100 cheaper. I think you'll find that the minimum required hardware to run these games is $100 to $150 cheaper, right? So instead of needing a $900 computer, maybe you need a $700 or $750 or an $800 computer. And so you'll have a lower cost entry into it, and I think the developers will have had more time to kind of perfect their implementation methodology for VR in general. The only thing I kind of worry about in terms of like 30 games, 50 games is what is the depth of those games? I know several of those games on each platform are, you know, they're full games, they're, 10 plus hour experiences or whatever. But a lot of the stuff that I have played thus far on both platforms is really demo-ish type stuff. Like, see how cool we can do this, right? See how neat this is. And I'm very interested to hopefully over the next handful of days here, since I have access to a pre for a little while, spend more time with it and say, what is this something that I could see myself doing for multiple hours at a time in a play session, either both physically being able to handle it or, are the games available kind of enough to make you want to do that even. But I do think it's fair that it's like, hey, 12 to 18 months, this could be very different. But I still think these will be the major players in the field, both in terms of the hardware guys.
That seems like a good time for us to move. Could you talk about the prices coming down? You got the VR system build guides. I would like to note that I think these are great gaming PCs too, but there is no cheap is no $500 VR machine right now. I'm playing around with the Dell box over there that comes in at a little under $1,000. You pretty much start the VR system build guide at $900. That seems pretty reasonable to me, looking at the specs, looking what I've what we're hearing from people. You know, Core i5 6500, Gigabyte H170, 8 gigs of RAM, and pretty much the entry level, the GTX 970. You guys chose EVGA's GeForce GTX 970 Superclock. A 250 gigabyte Evo drive plus a 2 terabyte Barracuda drive, 500 watt power supply, you know, an inexpensive Cooler Master CPU cooler, an inexpensive case. The total ends up being $939. But it basically comes down to, you know, a quad core i5, a GTX 970 and 8 gigabytes of RAM are the entry level for VR.
Right. So, right. You could change a lot of these parts surrounding those components.
Sure.
Right. And kind of basically get to the same price point. And it matches up with what Palmer Luckey from Oculus said, right? Hey, you'll get into our ecosystem for $1,500. I think he said that, you know, early 2015 or something like that. And the world blew up and thought that meant that the Rift was going to be $1,500. But it was $600 for the headset. And then, okay, $900. This is, you have a $900 budget to build a PC. And it's pretty spot on that, like, the minimum recommended specs that they put out there hit that $900 price point in pretty much every configuration.
So moving up to the $1,500 build, which is a Core i7-6700K. Love that processor. 16 gigs of RAM and a GeForce GTX 980 GPU with 4 gigabytes of RAM. What's the performance? Because what's the experience? What's the difference you get between going, you know, from the 970 to the 980, doubling the RAM and giving yourself some more CPU on that?
So it's a really interesting discussion to have because the majority of the games I have seen, the VR-based games I have seen, not all, but the majority, do not have image quality setting adjustments there. Mm-hmm. Right. So Adrift is a good example. Adrift is a game that will be released both on the PC, just like standard 2D, you know, game that you'll play on a monitor with a controller, and it will be available in VR. The version that sells on just PC will have your image quality settings, textures, you know, poly counts, you know, AA. Yes, all the settings you're used to seeing, you know, in PC games will be available on that. But on the VR version, I talked to the developer CTO, and they said they just made the conscious decision to remove all of that. And it seems to be that either at the push of Oculus and Valve, or maybe it's just the developers kind of making this realization that they need and want the VR experience to be perfect for everybody the first time. And so they seem to be targeting that GTX 970 already on R9 290 platform for this is where we're going to like tweak our game settings to so that we hit 90 FPS on that hardware, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody has a nice smooth VR gaming experience. And that's great. That's fantastic because we want people who buy that $900 system to have a solid VR experience. But what's the negative is that if you buy a 980 or 980 Ti, it looks like, at least initially, a lot of the games won't take advantage of the extra horsepower. Huh. Now, I have seen several games that are doing that. Eve Valkyrie, for example, has settings you can go in there and adjust. I believe I'm blanking on the other space sim game that's coming out for VR platforms all of a sudden. I can't remember, but it will have image quality settings. I'll find it here in a second. Elite Dangerous. Thank you, Alan. That will have image quality settings. There are other games that do. I think Hover Junkers is one that does. So some games do, right. But I would say it's maybe 70-30 that don't have it. So in those games with a 980 or 980 Ti or whatever you build your system at higher than that, you'll be able to take advantage of better image quality, what you're used to doing on a PC. I think it will take a few months for web developers to become comfortable with the platform, that they know that they have an understanding of what to look for when they're profiling their own game, how to make sure they're not going to dip below 90 at certain settings, and start to ease people into the idea of, okay, now you can adjust things. Because what they don't want to do, what a lot of guys don't want to do, is something that I saw happen to me this week, where you're playing Eve Valkyrie, and the 970 defaults to medium settings. You're like, great. This actually looks fantastic. It plays well. What happens if I turn up everything to ultra? So you turn up everything to ultra and suddenly it's running at 40-something frames per second. It's, you're queasy. You see stutter and judder on everything. It's a really bad experience for VR. And you're like, okay, you don't want to do that. But there will be still be some people, some hard-headed PC gamers that go, no, I want to be able to adjust these things up, not knowing that may be causing themselves discomfort on the other side. So there's going to have to be a balance in how developers teach people how the settings affect them. And I think it'll take a little bit for that to happen. So I still see we have a $1,500 build up now, and on tomorrow we're going to post our $2,500 build. And I still think those platforms have value for not just VR gaming, but for all PC gaming. But for VR gaming, say, this summer, where more games come out that are intensive on the graphics side, and when developers start to really discuss the idea of allowing you to modify things outside of what they have profiled for the lowest-end platform.
I sense excitement. I'm feeling it. We want the prices to come down, and we want more predictable games. It's so funny to see things like Flash-based games from 2007 be revived for you know, the gaming platform of the future.
Yes,
but I don't know. I'm almost excited about it again. It was the first GDC I've missed that I've actually been
been like, I should have gone. I really should have gone this year.
Yeah. But it was neat. I got to see, it was good to see a lot of the final demos of things like the Star Wars Tatooine kind of experiment that ILM did. That was cool, and kind of get some hands-on time with actual real games of stuff as opposed to just demos. So, but now we're here. It's Thursday as we record this. On Monday, the first Rifts will be arriving at consumers' houses, right?
Dun, dun, so, dun.
It will be here. We're supposed to have our retail Rift on Monday morning, so I don't know what we're going to do, but something probably.
Something will be done.
Something probably.
Oh, man. I wonder how many planes are full of Rifts as of like Sunday night or Saturday night. You know, you may have heard earlier this week a company called Apple did an event. Many of you are Apple enthusiasts. I myself am holding one of Apple's iPhone 6 is right here. Apple's green. Apple has... It was funny because it was one of those things where they spent like forever talking about how green they are. The new robot that tears apart iPhones, which actually was pretty awesome. Anytime you see an automated device gently taking apart equipment in a way that is actually really difficult to do as a human is pretty awesome. You know, solar cells run everything. 93% of their energy is renewable. It's all awesome and great. And then they finally got around to products. And the big one, I think, for me was the iPhone SE. Apparently, Apple sold 30 million 4-inch iPhones last year. There's a lot of people that do not want the big phone. And I got to say, you know, every so often when I'm holding my device, I'm thinking to myself, you know, or I pick up my wife's phone and I'm like, you know, this feels so good. Gosh, this screen is small, but this feels so good. And Apple listened. So they basically put flagship specs inside of a 4-inch phone. So a 4-inch Retina display, A9 chip, 12-megapixel EyeSight camera. Initial battery tests are coming out from some of the early testers this morning, and you're looking at probably, in some cases, you know, 2 hours longer. Where their tests got like 8 hours out of an iPhone 6, they're getting 10 hours plus out of an iPhone SE, which makes sense given that everything we've seen so far is the higher resolution 6-inch screens consume a lot more energy than the 4-inch screens. Considerably, you know, like 70% faster on Geekbench than the iPhone 5 SE, which is a big difference, or the iPhone 5S. And Apple's only claiming, you know, Apple's claiming like 2x faster CPU performance. But basically, it brings it up to speed with the iPhone 6S, which is a big deal. It's a huge jump over the iPhone 5S in terms of graphics performance, a big improvement on the camera, you know, Touch IDs being added in to the smaller form factor. 802.11ac Wi-Fi LTE. It's pretty good. You know, the closest thing I have to a complaint is that, and of course I almost forgot rose gold, which will show up on the screen in a second. It's, you know, it's all about the rose gold. You know, the closest thing I have to a complaint on it is looking at the pricing is not bad. It's $399, except that that's a 16-gigabyte phone, and I cannot in good conscience tell anybody to buy a 16-gigabyte phone. The upside is they have a 64-gigabyte phone, but that you know, takes the price up from $399 to $499, which is, for $100 to quadruple the capacity is a big deal if you are ordering an iPhone, especially if you've never had an iPhone before. Get more memory. There is no micro SD card slot. There is no expansion, and you will run out of storage for photos, or your connection to the cloud will fail at a time when you desperately need more memory. But, you know, it's a pretty badass phone for a four inch iPhone. I'm actually curious to see how the adoption is, and whether or not my wife looks at me and goes, "It's time for my new phone." So. The other big thing, and it was interesting, I read a great column this morning where somebody pointed out that Phil Schiller basically made fun of people who have 5-year-old PCs that are still using them, or 6-year-old PCs.
Yeah.
You know, and people who, you know, I guess aren't smart enough to invest in an iPad Pro because it is the future and the glory of all things in terms of personal computing, which is outside of artists who like the pencil, is the complete opposite of what I've been hearing in people who are iPad Pro users. they did announce, this was in the process of leading up to the announcement of the 9.7-inch iPad Pro. which is coming in a 256 gigabyte version inside of this first 256 gigabyte iPad, 9.7 inches, you know, 437 grams in weight, you know, the 2040 by 1536 resolution. So that's a 264 PPI display, which is basically the same, not quite, yeah, actually the exact same pixels per inch as a 12.9 inch Retina display, 8 IDEX chip with an M9 coprocessor. They're a nice kind of step up, a 12 megapixel EyeSight camera, which does live photos, focus pixels, true tone flash, 63 megapixel panorama photos, auto HDR for photos. The aperture is down to f2.2, which is pretty nice. 4K video recording is available. It's a step up over the 12.9 inch iPad Pro, along with the other camera features. The four speaker audio. Dual microphones. You know, the big question for me is, you know, what the adoption is going to be like. Are there a lot of people who did not or were not interested in the larger version that are going to go for this one? But I thought it was interesting. They're claiming now it's the least reflective screen.
Yeah, that was interesting.
That's out there. And I want to say like a 500 nit display, which is incredibly bright. That's the kind of numbers you get for equipment that was designed to be used on the deck of a boat in all of the sunlight. I remember hearing that being like, wow. So, you know, and using my computer outdoors fairly regularly, the idea of being able to have a super bright screen that is not reflective makes it a really compelling for people who are, whether they are insurance adjusters or, you know, anybody who's working outside and dealing with filling in forms and the interwebs. I think it's an interesting development for them. I think they're going to probably sell a ton of them in the enterprise. I'm kind of curious to see if people, you know, smaller businesses or individuals buy them. Not cheap.
No.
Not cheap at all. It starts at $600. Which you could say is $100 less than the 12-inch version, but that's a 32-gigabyte Wi-Fi version. By the time you get up to the 256-gigabyte version, it's $899 for the Wi-Fi version and $1,029 for the Wi-Fi Plus cellular version. You know, and if memory serves, that's without the pencil.
Yes.
Or the
yes,
smart keyboard.
Is. Yes.
So, if you want accessories...
Do you buy the idea that it's a like a replacement for a PC? I do not still.
No, I don't think Android. I know people who have replaced the vast majority of their desktop PC or laptop usage with an iPad or an Android tablet. I think it really depends on what you're doing and how well the Android or iOS applications have been created. I think for a lot of people who don't spend the majority of their day in a single application, it can be frustrating, even with the new pro versions of the operating system, to deal with multiple applications simultaneously.
Right.
You know, if you spend 90% of your day inside of a drawing app, if you spend 90% of your day doing email and you have the keyboard, if you spend 90% of your day in a particular form-based system, that allows you to interact with, you know, if you spend the majority of your time, you know, in one app or one or two apps, I think it works really well for, you know, we're also on the content creation edge of the bell curve, right? Where at the far end of the bell curve is my friend's dad who owns a computer because he plays checkers. And in the middle of the bell curve is, you know, everybody who's like, well, you know, I've got Facebook and I've got the internet. I do my tax software and occasionally I do the photos for the kids or I do the photos for my parents. And, you know, I edited a video last week. That was really cool. But we're all the way on the far right of the bell curve where it's like, you know, I'm editing a web page. I'm editing a video. I'm encoding a video. I'm encoding two videos. I'm editing another web page. I'm turning around and I'm, you know, compiling something so I can run it on this thing over here. So
right.
For people who programmers, developers, content creators, heavy gamers, all that stuff, they're not going to replace their desktop PC, you know, with an iOS or an Android-based tablet. But, you know, but there's kind of a sweet spot where you're spending a lot of time in applications that work particularly well on iOS that could be really, really compelling. It's a fast processor. I'm really curious to get some hands-on time with that 9.7-inch screen because it sounds utterly fantastic. but it is a professional tool, and it is priced professionally.
Yep.
To say the very least about
Fair
that.
Fair enough.
So 9.3 updates coming. The big thing of that, of course, is Night Shift, which you might know as Efflux, kind of continuing a long-standing Apple tradition of co-opting really awesome software and building it into the operating system, and being able to lock notes, which actually is a pretty cool concept to me. So Alan's been busy this week.
Yeah.
You know, he's got all the Helium drives. And he's been playing around, looking at 32-layer VNAND versus 48-layer VNAND flash, the Evo V1 and V2, the Samsung 850 drives. Yep. How is the 32 versus the 48-layer flash memory testing coming out?
So the good news is that there's almost no difference. There's pretty much no discernible difference between the two. And that's actually what you wanted. That's actually what you wanted. The bad news is in other previous not Samsung-related issues of this occurring, where we've seen kind of discrete replacement of flash and SSDs, it has oftentimes resulted in lower performance. So a drive might be released in January, you know, they send it out to reviewers, we write reviews, and then in May, they, you know, either due to a shortage or due to a change in vendor, they change the flash and the performance changes, and it has always gone down in those instances. And, you know, some companies got called out for it because they should have, you know, released a new model number or whatever and kind of been more open about it. And so we knew that Samsung was going to do this with the 850 Evo, that they'd had 32-layer NAND, they were going to go to 48-layer NAND, and they were going to keep that in the 850 Evo lineup. So as you see, like the pictures on the second page where you can see the internals of the PCB, you know, you're basically getting double the capacity per die, so you have half the number of chips on it. But at least in the 1 terabyte capacity that we've tested thus far, there's really no performance differences between the 48-layer and the 32-layer versions of the drive, which is good, right? That means we don't have a problem with them continuing to call this the 850 Evo. You know, you're not going to suddenly get way less performance because you bought a newer version of the drive as opposed to an older version of the drive, or even vice versa, right? Like that. We wanted to know if the new 850 Evos were going to be significantly faster in any way.
There's no penalty for buying the new one.
Correct.
Which is good. We like
right.
this.
Right. Yep. Yep.
Yay.
Yeah. So it's if anything, the new one might be a little bit faster in a few cases in terms of latency. But there's, you know, again, they're meeting or exceeding all the rated specifications and reviews that are already out there. So, you know, we've got no complaints in that regard.
No complaints is a big deal.
That's a plus.
So what's going on with the Western Digital Red 8 terabyte full review went up at the beginning of this week. The consumer Helium hard drive disk. One of the things we found out from the Backblaze you know, sort of annual 2015 annual state of the how many hard drives we killed report was that Helium drives, which you could sort of argue that they are, well, that basically the original story was that the Hitachi drive company, which it sort of went from, you know, IBM to Hitachi and now Western Digital, it was a corporate and enterprise drive. It was a completely a small organization inside of Western Digital or a business unit. And now we're seeing the Helium technology, which is considered to be why these drives are so reliable, coming over to the Western Digital side of things on the red sides. These are huge. 8 terabytes on a single drive. You know, the you know, data transfer rate max speed in theory is the same as the 6 terabyte, the 5 terabyte, the 4 terabyte, the 3 terabyte, the 2 terabyte, the 1 terabyte. You know, not a huge power draw. How did the testing go on this one?
Well, actually, so the Red series is one that, that we've recommended for a while for people who are doing any kind of like multi drive array configurations, whether it be 2 or 5 or 10.
Your drives and your NAS to die, get a Red.
Right. Right.
Or your data to die.
Correct. So, you know, the idea was like, oh, at first people might think, well, this is a WD Red, you know, 6 terabyte. They've increased it to 8 terabytes, whatever, move on. But that's clearly, you know, that's not what they did. If you look at what it shares more in design to the HGST Helium HE8 series of drives than anything else. Physically, they're identical as well. Performance wise, though, the it's still a 5,400 RPM drive, the 8 terabyte Red, and its performance kind of increases basically linearly with, you know, when you went from the 4 to the 6, now to the 8, right? You're getting improvements in density, improvements in just performance across the board, right? If you look at that graph right there, you'll see that the average has gone from, you know, 109 to 129 to 144 in terms of megabytes per second when looking at kind of average throughput on the drives, which is what we wanted, right? That's kind of right. What you expected, and the move to Helium helps them get to 8 terabytes a little bit sooner, maybe a little bit less expensive than any other technology they have that would have gotten them there. It was a pre-existing technology in their company's portfolio now because of you know, the HGST acquisition and whatnot. So it was kind of on the burner, ready to go. It does have a little bit of a performance advantage, or a little bit more than linear performance advantage in some areas, like our file copy test, because it has 128 megs of cache on the drive as opposed to 64. So that's going to help in some specific areas as well. But otherwise, I mean, we're talking about hard drive speeds that are increasing at the kind of rate that you would expect them to increase, I guess. It's what it is. It's an expensive drive, but in terms of its capacity, you know, your cost per gigabyte, I think we're looking at, what was it, 31 cents per gig, I believe. I think when we wrote this, it was selling for like $333 on Amazon for a single 820 or 8 terabyte drive. So 4.1 cents per gigabyte is what you get there. So essentially the same cost per gigabyte as you have with one of the 6 terabyte drives. But if you compare that to the HE8 8 terabyte drive, the HGST version, kind of the enterprise drive, it's over $420. So it's like 5.3 cents per gig. So it's significantly more expensive, but the HE8 drives do spin at 7,200 RPM instead of 5,400 RPM. So they should be faster in pretty much all regards. But this is kind of like the 6 was before it. This is kind of just, okay, if you're trying to get the most possible density for your upcoming array, you don't have to get 8 of them like shown in that Drobo right there. But if you're trying to get a RAID 1 array and you want the most capacity you can get, 2 8-terabytes is the way to go. It's more expensive, but it's not more expensive per gigabyte than the drive we were recommending previous to that. So still the same kind of cost structure, if you will.
It's interesting looking at sort of the latency numbers and the IO meter numbers, there's kind of definitely a pack in terms of the majority of the Western Digital Red drives. In some cases, you know, like there's one case where like Western Digital Black and the Western Digital Red Pro 6 terabyte kind of break out, like random read speeds are considerably higher. And then you turn around and the standard Red 6 terabyte or the Western Digital Black and the Red 4 terabyte breakout, you know, and another one of the random writes tests, they're kind of holding their own for the majority of the Red drives. There's only a couple of the Red drives that are considerably faster than the others. But yeah, I can see why Alan would really want to see a pro version of the 8 terabytes to see that extra bit of oomph added to the performance, especially on sequential read numbers. So,
which is interesting if you go to the next story.
Interesting wrinkle with the 8 terabyte my book.
Yeah. So Western Digital has always offered both an internal and an external version of pretty much all their drives. Right. You can buy an external MyBook 8 terabyte drive, single drive that's like a USB 3 device, and you had the internal one, right? Well, interestingly, the 8 terabyte MacBook has been for sale longer than we have known about the Western Digital Red 8 terabyte. So Sebastian went out to his local Best Buy, picked one up after some discussions internally, and ripped it apart and wanted to see what was in it. And as it turns out, a WD Red is not inside that casing. If you take off the first sticker that's labeled WD 8 terabyte desktop drive for MacBook, which is about as generic as you can get, there's actually a blank sticker underneath that. And then underneath that is the original HGST label, right? So as it turns out, it looks like the first wave of Western Digital MacBooks, at least the first wave that hit Best Buy, was actually using an HGST HE8 drive, which is a 7200 RPM enterprise class product, as opposed to the consumer class WD Red. Nice. Now, what makes that more interesting is that the WD MacBook sells for $249. So not only is the external drive with like the housing and the USB 3 and all that stuff, you know, about $80 less than the WD Red, it's like $180 less than the HGST Bear drive. Right. So in theory, if you had Best Buy near you and you wanted a couple of these drives to run in RAID, or you wanted one 8 terabyte drive, right now, the most cost effective way is to go buy one of the external drives and take it apart and get the hard drive that's in it. Now, at some point, we expect the HGSTs will be replaced by actual WD Reds or equivalents inside these housings. But it appears that they just didn't have the drives ready for when they needed to start that manufacturing process and distribution process for the WD MacBooks. So it looks like people who bought some of those or are buying those early are getting exceptional deals for their hard drives. But like I said, we've only tested a sample of one at Best Buy. No idea if the ones you order off Amazon will have the HGST 7200 RPM drive or the Western Digital 5400 RPM drive. But in my opinion, either way, it's a deal, right? The internal drive is $340. The external drive is $250. There's like an $80 to $90 difference there, and all it takes is a little spudger to pop it out and do that. Although you might have warranty issues to deal with if your hard drive dies, if you've removed it might. From a housing. So
might have warranty issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm kind of pregnant, Mom. Might have warranty issues. They'll know
if
in that case. Oh, my goodness. I've been playing around a lot with very, very small ITX systems, so I am curious about the CryOridge C7, essentially a 47-millimeter tall air cooler. It's designed to fit anywhere a stock Intel air cooler will fit. But if you are familiar with stock Intel air coolers, you might notice that this thing is somewhat more significantly built, to say the least. Sebastian Peak writing this up for PC Per. You know, it's a beautiful heatsink. It's $30, which is cheap.
Yeah.
It is cheap even. It is inexpensive. It is competitively priced even for a even for an air cooler. You know, nicely packaged, you know, maybe not the most bomb-proof looking back plate, but the plastic back plate at least won't create any issues on the back of your system. Build looks solid, nice clean thermal plate. The instructions are actually looked like they were put together by somebody who wanted to help you figure out which of the tiny bag of parts or bag full of tiny parts you actually needed to make your CPU cooler function with your motherboard. Having pulled and replaced 3 or 5 of these in the last few months, plus some liquid coolers, I find really nice instructions to be really, really helpful, just so I don't spend all of the time pulling little screws out and finding out they don't fit and pulling the right one out and pulling the wrong one out again. The performance is not spectacular, which is kind of a bummer. You know, taking a look at the performance, and it should also put into context here, when you look at the, you know, at the benchmarks for the cooler temperatures on an Intel Core i5-6600K, that's on the last page of the review. You know, the majority of this, the majority of the parts listed on this page are full-size aftermarket coolers and liquid coolers. But looking at the Scythe Ninja 4, which is a big old massive cooler, that's keeping the processor at 1.2 degrees centigrade above ambient, 25.2 degrees under load, and on a full stress test, about 36 degrees, which is fairly reasonable, assuming it's like a, you know, 60 degree room. When you get to the Cryoridge C7, you're looking at about 30% higher, almost exactly 30% higher on the temperatures. You know, 32.8 under load, 48.8 under full stress. So it's not the most effective aftermarket cooler, but it looks pretty good for a cooler of its size. And compared to the Intel stock cooler, it is a significant improvement. Not quite a 50% reduction under a stress test, but certainly in the neighborhood of that.
Correct.
So that's a really great price for that. It's funny because I've got a Noctua cooler in here. I've got a Zalman on there. And now I'm ready to try yet another, you know, small form factor cooler. Nice work, though, in terms of the ambient noise numbers, 34.8 under load, 34 under idle. That's pretty good and a significant improvement, I assure you, over a stock Intel cooler, to say the very least.
Right.
So Sebastian gave it a PC Perspective Gold Award and found no weaknesses on it given the price. So it's nice to see a really well-built cooler that's cheap. That costs,
They're essentially targeting that somebody who needs to replace that Intel stock cooler because it's the worst, right?
Yes.
And that's what it is. It
does what it needs to do. It keeps you from, you know, it. But if you spend a lot of time at load and you want to have the most performance out of your system, then you definitely want to replace the stock cooler when you get a chance.
Yeah, agreed.
Ryan Shrout wrote up deep and abiding sadness from the land of Intel. The TikTok processor production era has officially been ended by Intel. Yesterday's process technology, a tick was the new process, a talk was the new architecture, is now just process architecture optimization, process architecture optimization. Does this mean they're no longer in competition with different divisions of Intel, or have they decided that they're just so far ahead of everybody else, they can kind of lighten up?
So I think there's several reasons for them making this move. I think there's a technological reason where getting beyond 14 nanometer is really, really hard. Getting to 10, getting to the next node after 10 is becoming much more expensive, much more difficult. So there's a financial benefit for them to extend the life of each process node, right, in terms of the number of products and families that they can introduce on each technology node. There's also the, as you were pointing out, like there's not a whole lot of competition for them, right? They've been the process leader for a long time. They're leaders in the CPU space. They are leaders in like the mobile space in terms of laptops and that type of stuff. They're still not the, you know, leaders technologically in like phones and tablets, although they're doing their best to get there. So there's that aspect of it as well. I just think it became too difficult to tell top level executives and maybe the board that we need to spend 25 to 35% more budget each node in order to continue to keep up with, you know, the Moore's Law expectations there. It's disappointing because over the last decade or so that we've been on this TikTok cadence, we have seen Intel's technology dramatically change and shift, right? Josh and I were discussing last night that, like, well, we really haven't seen improvements on the CPU side, like desktop side, like huge IPC improvements generation to generation, like since the introduction of Sandy Bridge. And that's true, but it's only mostly because they've switched their focus to like the mobile side. If you compare what existed in 2009 or whatever for a laptop versus what you can get in a laptop today, there's going to be a significant advantage on a Skylake platform today, and that's through advantages in architecture and through advantages in process tech. So I mean, we kind of knew this was going to happen after all the rumors about the Kaby Lake product coming out after Skylake but before the next architecture shift. So we knew that they were kind of going into this three-part cadence instead of this two-part cadence. The only concern is will they extend that past a three-part cadence anytime in the near future, right? Would they say, you know what, as it turns out, 10's pretty good for a while. We're actually going to do 4 on that, maybe 5 products on that, and try to, you know, it'll do process, what was it? It would be process architecture, optimization, or something like that, right? We don't want to see that as consumers because you want to see continual improvements, but from a company standpoint, you understand why they're doing it, I guess.
And the reality is for the vast majority of users, you know, a current Core i5 is so much more processor than they need, and the Core i7 is pretty much overkill. I feel comfortable in saying that.
It is, and on the desktop side, that will be the case, but like the next goal for Intel should be to get, you know, 4770K performance in my laptop with acceptable battery life, right? And that will be improved through architectural changes and process technology changes. So it just may slow down some, I guess, maybe. I don't know. Intel would argue that, obviously, but
Intel would argue with a fence post if the time was right. Yeah. Speaking of Intel, we should probably also give a shout out to the loss this week of former Intel CEO Andy Grove.
Yes.
An absolutely lovely tweet, series of tweets, actually. One of the nicest ones from Tim Cook. Andy Grove, one of the giants of the technology world. He loved our country and epitomized America at its best. Rest in peace. Malik, Andy Grove, rest in peace. Thank you for inspiring all of us who are immigrant founders. Your plain talk will be missed. Mark Andreessen, rest in peace, Andy Grove. The best company builder Silicon Valley has ever seen and likely ever will see. Extraordinary human being, extraordinary story. Survived the nightmare that was the Third Reich in World War II, emigrated to the United States, and was an extraordinary manager. And if, built Intel, really hammered home sort of what we think of as the venture capital improvement, striving to exceed maniacal 24/7, 365, build, grow, improve culture of Silicon Valley. A huge amount of that can be laid at his feet. And also apparently one of the most ruthless managers and competitors ever. But if you enjoy how fast your processors are and how much power you have for the amount of money you're paying, give a nod of the hat, tip of the hat to Andy Grove. A huge, huge part of that actually existing. So,
indeed.
Bringing it back up, Logitech G900 Chaos Spectrum Wireless Ambidextrous Mouse. This is a fancy enclosure, and I'm always excited when I see a gaming mouse that, I don't know, in this case resembles an angry beetle more than the usual look. We stole this off of the set of a sci-fi movie where all of the things are angular. But, you know, for the Southpaws in the audience, this is a mouse you can use without being incredibly frustrated.
I've actually been using it for 4 days as well. And I'm not a Southpaw. I'm right-handed, and it's a universal mouse. They've had a lot of requests, they said, for left-handed or ambidextrous mice, and they were trying to get back into that. There's some unique things on this mouse. So it's wireless. It's a wireless gaming mouse. And the first thing they wanted to talk about to us when we met with them at GDC was like, look, wireless mice get a really negative rap from gamers because they talk about latency and battery life and all this other stuff. And they did some pretty thorough testing. And they brought up like specific testing methodologies and the exact competitors they were trying to compete against. And they showed like, hey, you know, we're going to get better battery life than anything else. We're going to have better accuracy than other wireless mouse, lower latency than a lot of other wired mice have due to the technology inside the mouse. So I didn't run that testing, so I take their word for it, but take it for whatever you will. It has other interesting features like what you're seeing right there. Because it's ambidextrous, the side panels come off, and you can choose to have either two, you know, thumb buttons on the left-hand side or the right-hand side or both of the mouse or none, I guess, either.
I love the fact that you can make the buttons on the side of the mouse go away. I think that is outstanding.
You can, you can just have, if you just want the two buttons up top, you know, and the third and the click wheel, you can absolutely do that. It is a wireless mouse that has a, if you go back into the pictures, you'll see one of the USB cord that it comes with is long enough for you to make it a wired mouse. I'll scroll up to the picture above it, maybe. Yeah. Notice the cable on the right-hand side, the end of the cable, has like these two kind of arms coming off of it. Of plastic, it makes it impossible to use this cable for anything other than your mouse, which is, you know, whatever. but what that does is, if you scroll down to the next picture down, is it actually helps brace the cable inside the mouse. So some people had said that, yes, I've had wireless mice that plug in through a USB connection in the front, but over time, the stress on that joint, if you will, or that junction can kind of wear out. You might get some bending in it, and those arms kind of prevent that. And then they give you that little accessory there is the idea is you run the power cable or the USB cable from your PC up to your desk. And on top of your desk, you leave this little micro to full size adapter and you plug the little wireless receiver into it. If the battery is low, but you still want to use the mouse, you pull out that block part of it, right? Right. Disconnects it from being a wireless mouse, plug it into the USB cord, and you have a wired mouse that shows up in the software as such, and you keep using it. You don't really have to stop and wait for it to charge or swap a battery or anything like that. It's got RGB lights on that G logo on the middle of it, of course, hence the name, the Chaos Spectrum. The scroll wheel is one of those ones you can swap between like the smooth scroll and the click scroll, which I greatly appreciate because I do find myself swapping between them quite frequently. There's some cool stuff in here, and you can look at my post I did about it on PCPro.com, and they go into the details about how they tested latency, how they tested RF interference for the wireless stuff, and you'll see the results they have there. We'll spend some more time at this mouse and see what other interesting stuff we can come up with. But I do not have an anechoic chamber to do RF interference testing, so that will just have to be a debate that we have until they give me carte blanche access to theirs. We'll see which happens first. It is $150, so it's expensive. Battery life is supposed to be rated at 34 hours of continuous use. Huh. Right. So like 34 hours of it being
used
moved
constantly.
In a circle. Yeah. That's without the LED lights on. With the RGB lights on, I think that drops to like 24, which is, you know, if you're like me, who I have a travel mouse that I'm used to pretty much never charging, like once a year, you swap the double A's in it or something like that. Right. It's going to feel like, oh, man, 32 hours is not that long. I've had mine for 5 days now as my primary work PC mouse, and I have yet to have to charge it. So it's, you know, it's there. And you'll get, the idea is obviously what you hate to have is a mouse that you're using, you don't realize it's about to die and it dies. But with the USB cable kind of on top of the desk, if that were to happen, and you don't notice a little pop-up from the Logitech software on your PC. The idea is, well, okay, fine, disconnect it, connect that USB cable. You've got a wired mouse now until it's done charging and you're still good to keep on using the device. Yeah, it's pretty nice.
It's a couple fun products on Tech Thing this week. Synology has taken their NAS operating system and adapted it to a router. They've been selling it outside the U.S. for 6 or 8 months, so they just started selling it in the U.S. It's an interesting device, the Synology router RT1900 AC. Fairly competitive in terms of performance, although it's been interesting to watch. Some people's testing results puts it in the top tier of RT1900 routers. Some testing results put it lower on the list in terms of performance. But the real story behind this is that operating system inside of there, you know, beamforming is basically all the 802.11ac routers are doing that. But the Synology router manager, which is very similar if you've ever run a NAS, if you scroll down a little bit, is the thing that really sets us apart from most of the routers we see. Super easy setup. Something I didn't get into that I wish I did was some of the stuff they're doing. They have an onboard inspection engine. They call it, you know, your basic deep packet inspection engine, where they're trying to help you analyze your traffic in terms of uploads, downloads, and isolating who and what is taking on the majority of the bandwidth automatically. And because it's got 4 gigabytes of storage instead of, say, 128 megabytes, you have a massive amount of room for onboard log files. You don't have to stuff a USB drive in. But if you do put a USB drive in, you can take advantage. You can turn it into a media server, a VPN server, a download station. The VPN, actually, server is pretty awesome. So if you want to run OpenVPN or a number of other specs, but you can add in additional applications, add on software packages without having to replace the firmware. Download station is essentially a BitTorrent or download box. Media server is a DLNA compliant server. The VPN server allows up to 5 simultaneous connections for any of the basic VPN services. A DNS server and a Radius server. Radius being an enterprise login and encryption tool. So they obviously see this. You know, some people taking this at home. Some people are going to be using this in a small office that are kind of stepping up. But an interesting collection of features. Performance was good. In some cases, I got triple the performance compared to an Archer C7. In one corner of my house, the what I refer to as the distant corner. In the difficult corner, this was recording fairly robust speeds, but I could not actually browse the web using it, which I thought was a little strange. But overall, thumbs up. But the real driver for this is the applications, and if you're interested in the operating system. Which has a lot of potential. The other funny thing I got to play around with, have you used a standalone GPS navigation unit recently in the last couple of years, right?
Your
phone taken over?
Yeah.
I got to test out Garmin's latest, their 60 LMT, which is, you know, 6-inch display. They do a 5-inch version of it. It's about 25% less. I forgot how good a standalone GPS can be. I don't know if anybody out there is in the market or has a family member that's in the market. But in terms of the lane assist, the way the traffic is integrated, you know, they're playing around with a lot of stuff, like what they call Garmin Real Directions, which is telling you to, you know, basically giving you landmarks to identify, which I think is pretty cool work until you, like, you know, turn left after, you know, a particular building or, you know, some visible landmark. I forgot how good the lane guidance is, because that's not so, this Google Maps does not seem to do a very good job of, if you're, we run into it a lot here in the Bay Area or in California, where there's 6 lanes and 2 of them go somewhere and 1 of them goes somewhere and these 4 in the middle split in 3 different directions. But it was, you know, it's clean and simple, and between, you know, playing around with, Shannon just bought a really nice Sony DSLR, or I should say DSLR, you know, and playing around with dedicated audio players. It's amazing how good and easy to use and simple a one device or one function device can be. So there's an optional wireless backup camera that costs almost as much as the Garmin Drive 60 LMT if you want to integrate that in there. But if you're looking for a really nice standalone GPS unit, this is a really nice standalone GPS unit. Free lifetime maps and traffic. If you don't want the traffic, then the price drops considerably. Just wanted to throw that out there. So
interesting.
It was fun to play with. It's amazing how good some things can be.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's also amazing how many different, you know, apps there are, including Sigic. If you travel to the middle of nowhere and you need a map, I got the GPS app for you. So, oh my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we should probably bring this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware to a close. If this is your first show, welcome. We're so glad you're here. Do us a favor, go to twit.tv/TWICH. You can get all the information, all of our older shows, all the information on how to download the shows on whatever your favorite podcatcher type device is or application, and the RSS feed if you have an existing podcatcher that you know and love. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, you can find at Ryan Shroud or at Patrick Norton on Twitter. Ryan's usually at pcper.com. I'm usually at techroom.com. We want to thank you all for joining us today's episode. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shroud.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.